This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte.
There's been a lot of conversation about the possibility of contracting COVID-19 in small spaces like elevators, but there's really been very little to no research that's actually been done to find out if there is an actual risk of exposure. Well, now there is a study. Otis Worldwide engineer Stephen Nichols has been working with Purdue University's Professor Yan Chen, who is a mechanical engineering professor, but he's also an expert that is widely recognized for his research into the spread and prevention of infectious disease through indoor air systems about how dangerous it is to actually take an elevator ride. And Mr. Nichols, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today to talk about it.
Thank you, Chris. Pleasure to be here.
Tell us, if you will, first about the study. Why did Otis Worldwide want to work, in this case, with Purdue University to find out what they're finding out?
So I think one of the things we realized fairly early on last year is that lots of people are asking questions, not just about the pandemic, but about the pandemic and elevators. So amid everything that was happening, we wanted to provide science-based information and help dispel some of the misconceptions. The ability to go to Purdue University and work with one of the world's best in this area and combine Professor Chen's research expertise, not just in airflow, but in the modeling of airflow, along with Otis's expertise in elevator technology, allowed us to do a lot of powerful research in a short amount of time.
What were some of the areas that Otis was most concerned about, as well as what Professor Chen wanted to delve into?
So I think when we talk about relative exposure risk, it's important to remember that we're talking about the intensity, duration, and frequency of exposure. So we already knew that the duration of an elevator ride is quite short. Even for the tallest buildings in New York, Chicago, and other cities, an elevator journey is less than 2 minutes. Most elevator rides are less than a minute, in some cases only 30 seconds. So that short duration of the elevator ride translates into a lower exposure risk. The ability to quantify and better understand the intensity of the exposure. So, for example, we know that elevators have a significant amount of air exchange by design. By code, all elevators have openings for ventilation. Those two things combined, along with kind of additional airflow from the fan, simple mitigation strategies like adding air purification, we wanted to better understand that. So the ability to look at it and model it in the computer, as well as compare it to other scenarios, not just riding an elevator, but quantifying, is that short trip in an elevator relatively lower risk compared to outdoor dining or grocery shopping? Mm-hmm. And we've been able to provide those combinations.
That's interesting. When you set up a program, a study like this to come up with the idea, and in turn, I guess, eventually for new elevators to be able to program them better, what kind of areas do you create when you do your testing?
Our testing is extensive. We look at all sorts of different parameters in all of the testing we do, not just in this area, but in all of our quality and robustness testing. The advantage of this work is we were able to do computer modeling and look through a variety of different scenarios quickly, both in the modeling and of the airflow, the modeling of the people moving, and then the elevator technology. So the ability to show that higher level of air exchange, those openings, and the simple mitigation strategies with the particle dynamics in an elevator was really the advantage of what we were able to do in this study.
Now, I know that in the past, when air conditioning was created, the fellow who invented the major sized air conditioner used to use models of rooms with wind tunnels and the like to be able to create the airflow that he in turn wanted to show in coming up with his invention. Does Otis do the same when it comes to creating this type of setup for elevators, especially when you're trying to design a new style of elevator?
Certainly, when we're looking at new technologies, we do different kinds of testing. Some kinds of physical testing, like the wind tunnel you're describing, as well as more and more over time modeling and computer. In this case, we chose to do sophisticated computer modeling in order to go quickly and in order to look at a variety of different situations. These are techniques that Professor Chen has used in modeling airborne exposure risk in aircraft cabins, for example. Mm-hmm. So we were able to use some of those best practices that Professor Chen brought to the table and enhance what we were already doing.
Now, with all this information at hand that Otis and Professor Chen had put together, what kind of advice do you have for people who are concerned about getting on elevators?
So I think that the best simple advice is wear your mask. The results of our study have shown that a short elevator ride with simple mitigation has a comparably low exposure risk, even lower with simple mitigation like wearing proper mask wearing and air purification. So the number one, wear your mask. Don't worry about the elevator, and hopefully that gives people confidence not only to return to work, but move about buildings and cities more comfortably.
Now, what kind of advice do you have for building owners that have those elevators?
So I think certainly considering the addition of air purification is something for building owners to look at. Again, wearing the mask, proper mask usage is a great mitigation for everyone. But also, really, what we want to share more than anything is that the science-based information and the results of this study have been able to show that the elevator is one of the best ventilated spaces in a building. That significant amount of air exchange and the ventilations required by elevator and building code are helping, and anything like mask usage and other simple mitigation strategies only lower the risk, the exposure risk, even more.
Now, let me ask, as we're finishing up here our conversation, we've talked a lot about the coronavirus, and that's what the study was looking into specifically. Do these same findings apply to the common cold or to the flu?
So I think the focus of the study was really on airflow and the airflow dynamics of something like COVID-19 moving through elevators. So certainly I'm not a medical expert, but the lower exposure risk and lower intensity of something like COVID-19 may be able to help with something like influenza.
Stephen Nichols is an engineer for Otis Worldwide, and Otis Worldwide has teamed up with Purdue University Mechanical Engineering Professor Yan Chen, who is known for his research into the spread of infectious diseases, to find out if elevators really are safe, especially as we're still dealing with the pandemic, and whether one riding in an elevator could in turn contract COVID-19. And Stephen, thank you very much for being with us with your information.
Thank you.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. February 7th is National Black HIV/AIDS Awareness Day. To find out more about the event coming up and about the topic in general, we have with us Dr. Laura Cheever. She's a physician and she's the Associate Administrator for the HIV/AIDS Bureau at the Health Resources and Services Administration. Dr. Cheever, thank you for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you so much for having me.
We know that that your organization and you in particular are very much involved in the Rhine-wide HIV/AIDS program, and that's one of the reasons that they take advantage of this very special day every year to make sure that Blacks, African Americans, who face the stigma and HIV-related health problems know about the help they can get through the organizations that are out there. Will you bring us up to date first for folks that are not familiar with what the HIV/AIDS Bureau is all about?
Yes. So the HIV/AIDS Bureau administers the Rhine-White HIV/AIDS Program, which is a federal program that's funded at about $2.3 billion a year. And it really is to provide HIV care and treatment services for people who don't have the means to get that treatment on their own. Either they're uninsured or underinsured, living at or below poverty. The program serves about half of all the people living with diagnosed HIV in this country. And we do that by funding states, cities, and local community-based organizations to provide HIV care and treatment and wraparound services.
I know a lot has been done over the years to be able to show that HIV is able to be managed, and it's gone from a very deadly disease to something that is very manageable. Will you tell us first about how some of the treatments are able to contain the disease and make it easier for people to survive, even when they may have been given a death sentence, so to speak, early?
Yes. So back when I first started providing HIV services in 1990, HIV was a death sentence. Most people diagnosed would be dead within a year or two. Today, because we have incredibly important advances in medical care and treatment, most people diagnosed with HIV can be started on one pill that they take once a day for the rest of their lives. If they are able to take that medication every day, they can become virally suppressed, which means they can live a near normal lifespan and have effectively no risk of transmitting HIV sexually to someone else. So it helps the person live a good, healthy, normal life and helps them from preventing HIV transmission to their loved ones.
What seem to be the statistics nationwide that show that that blacks in particular seem to be not as much perceptive about the disease, but they are maybe unaware of sometimes being alive and don't have the virus in them?
Yeah, so we definitely have some big disparities in HIV care in America. Of all the people diagnosed in 2018, 42% were African American, but they only composed 13% of the U.S. population. So you can really see how it much more heavily impacts the African American community. And that's similar to a lot of diseases. We've seen impacts, for example, of COVID and other illnesses that are just more impactful in those communities.
Mm-hmm.
We know that in the Ryan White program, when people get into care, they're provided care in a way that they can access it. They're provided assistance with things like transportation to their medical appointments, if they need help with childcare during medical appointments, that sort of thing. We provide that assistance so people can get in care and stay in care. And African Americans in our program do extremely well.
Will you give us an idea, as far as Indiana is concerned, on how the Ryan White HIV/AIDS program is doing, and some of the information as to show its impact?
Sure. So in 2019, our program served almost 8,000 people in Indiana, and of the people receiving services, people did incredibly well. 88% of clients overall were virally suppressed, which means they were able to access their medication and take it every day. Among African Americans, that was closer to about 85% were virally suppressed. And once again, that has to do with the challenges we have in providing care and treatment equitably in this country.
When you look at Ryan White, his example, going back into the 70s and 80s, observance, 40th anniversary observance. What do you feel that Hoosiers as well as other Americans might have learned from Ryan's example, and how it fits very well with our current event coming up, of course, the National Black HIV/AIDS Awareness Day?
Yes, yeah, so I stand in awe of Ryan White. He was a young boy, as you all know, in Indiana, diagnosed at age 13 with HIV that he acquired through blood transfusion. And when his mom asked him what he wanted to do, he said, "I want to go to school and be a normal kid for the rest of my life," which they predicted would be 6 to 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really prevented by doing that because of the tremendous stigma around HIV. By that point in time, we knew that HIV could not be transmitted in a classroom casually. Yet people were fearful of him. So he devoted the rest of his life. He ended up living several more years of beating the odds that his doctors had given him. But he spent the rest of his life fighting against HIV stigma. So that is incredibly important. And I can tell you that HIV stigma persists today. Ryan White provided important leadership in that area that continues to this date in terms of the need for reducing HIV stigma.
And I know his mother has continued on fighting the cause, so to speak.
Yes. So his mother is, we have a meeting of our national meeting of our program every 2 years. His mother is always there to really continue to provide that inspiration around the importance of combating HIV stigma as an important barrier to people actually getting care and treatment services.
Now, I know the HRSA has a very important role in dealing with the HIV pandemic and trying to end it. Will you talk a little bit about the what's called the Plan for America initiative and how the Ryan White Center fits into it?
Yes. So thank you for that question. So we can end the HIV epidemic in this country. We have the tools, we have the science we need to end the epidemic. And we've worked with Dr. Fauci at NIH and with our colleagues at CDC to model how to do that. So by putting together the importance of HIV testing, which 1 in 7 people do not know they have HIV in this country, they're living with HIV, so we need to get everyone tested, by increasing testing, increasing treatment. In our program, we do really well when people come into care, but a lot of people, because of stigma and discrimination, don't come into care when they know they have HIV. So we need to get people into care, make sure they know that there is low or no cost treatment available to them. And then we need to make sure that people that are continue to be at risk of HIV know about PrEP, which is pre-exposure prophylaxis, which is the idea that someone without HIV can take one pill once a day to prevent getting it if they're at high risk. So we put those things together with building better public health, and we can end this epidemic in 10 years. So we have a central role in that, particularly around getting people into care and treatment for HIV.
Does the Ryan White HIV/AIDS program have anything special planned, so to speak, as we come up to February 7th for the annual observance of the Awareness Day?
Yes, we definitely will take time out to look at the importance of HIV care and treatment during National Black HIV Awareness Day, and really highlighting the importance in the African-American community and the disproportionate impact that HIV continues to have today, to push to get the message out, particularly to African-American communities, about the importance of getting tested for HIV, and if you're living with HIV, to get into care and treatment.
Dr. Laura Cheever is a physician. She's also the associate administrator for the HIV/AIDS Bureau with the Health Resources and Services Administration. And Dr. Cheever, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about National Black HIV/AIDS Awareness Day. And we hope to have a chance to talk with you again, not only about the event, about the bureau that you work for, but also about the great achievements and legacy, I guess, of Ryan White. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
NIPSCO is getting involved in renewable energy projects, not only here in Indiana and in the Midwest in general. And we find out about two of the first projects that are already online. With us to talk about NIPSCO's initiative, which is entitled Your Energy, Your Future, we have first Andy Campbell. He is the lead participant of the NIPSCO Renewable Assets Team. And with us from NIPSCO headquarters, we have Tara McElmurray, who is a spokesperson and very much involved in the project. And Tara and Andy, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you, Chris.
Yeah, happy to be here.
If you will, first, Tara, give us an idea of the initiative itself, Your Energy, Your Future plan. What it's generally going to do as far as the utilities concerned and for consumers that are members of the NIPSCO team.
Yeah, absolutely. Our Your Energy, Your Future generation transition plan started back in 2018 when we were going through our integrated resource planning process, which is something we do every couple years. One thing that we did different in 2018 was we conducted a request for proposal process in which we, analyzed hundreds of proposals, checking to see what would be, the best source of generating energy for our customers going forward. And we found, which was actually quite a surprise to us with the technology advancements, that renewable resources such as wind, solar, and battery technology were actually most cost-effective for our customers. As a result of that, of moving forward with those technologies, we are going to be retiring both of our remaining coal plants. Our Schahfer Generating Station, which is in Wheatfield, Indiana, will be retired in 2023. And then our Michigan City Generating Station in Michigan City, Indiana, is planned to be retired in 2028. So we will be 100% coal-free by 2028. And in its place, we will be replacing that generation with, as I said, a mix of wind, solar, and battery technology, which will be joining our Sugar Creek Generating Station, which is our natural gas plant down in Terre Haute, mm-hmm. along with our hydroelectric generation, which is in Monticello, Indiana. And with all of that, we will be saving our customers more than $4 billion over the long term.
Andy, if you will, from the renewable assets team side, what did you all discover in talking with the contractors and getting the first two projects, certainly, that are now online, the Rosewater Wind and the Jordan Creek wind plants online? What have you learned that is going to be the future of NIPSCO with these projects and many more that are coming up?
Obviously, we are resolute in running our quest for proposals to really find the best projects. NIPSCO is not, quote-unquote, in the development business. So we want to leave the building of these assets to the quote-unquote professionals who do it every day, right? And the two wind farms that came online recently are consistent with kind of our short-term action plan to bring on some wind to gain some additional experience. The first one is in Jordan Creek in Benton Warren County, Indiana, 400 megawatts, and that's a purchase power agreement with our partners at NextEra Energy Resources. And a purchase power agreement is basically an agreement where NextEra will continue to own and operate the facility, and NIPSCO is agreeing to buy the power from there. Rosewater with a partner, EDP Renewables, is a joint venture asset, which is basically a different term for a NIPSCO project that NIPSCO will own. That project, in addition, will operate, and NIPSCO will have full responsibility for that project and is a part of its overall fleet. So with those projects, they were kind of the first offing of both of those structures for us, pursuant to the integrated resource plan that Tara mentioned. And then obviously we've had a number of announcements related to solar and other wind farm and battery storage that we expect to come online between now and 2023.
Tell us a little bit about the ones that folks here in Northwest Indiana are likely to see as far as the solar panels are concerned. I know there are some projects that are going to be planned for a place like in Jasper County in particular and some other counties in Indiana as well, too. Tell us about those.
We've announced bill transfer agreements, joint venture structures with NextEra Energy Resources. There's going to be two projects in Jasper County, right around 700 megawatts of solar installation and then a 75 megawatt battery as well. In addition, in White County, there'll be a 200 megawatt facility that has a 60 megawatt hour battery in addition. So those are all really well located in NIPSCO service territory. And, the technology in general is kind of advanced to the point where we feel it's an adequate replacement for the coal facilities. And, as far as locationally, we don't necessarily, tell these developers where to put these projects. The nature of the agreement is we either buy the power from the facility or we agree to buy the project when it's complete. And the development is really left to the professionals. And with wind and solar, it's important to have a lot of geographic diversity so that if the sun's maybe not shining in one spot, it's perhaps shining in another, or the wind is maybe diminished here and higher there. So having a mix of projects spread throughout our service territory as well as even other parts of the state can provide a value of diversity there to kind of protect that energy flow.
Do you think that's going to be the best advantage that NIPSCO has, is that if you have a day where maybe you have lots of sunshine here in the northwest corner of the state, but not so much in other places, and vice versa, that maybe it's cloudy here in Lake County, say, but it's not cloudy in Henry County over in the eastern side of the state, that you're going to have the advantage of shifting the power around?
So shifting the power around is key, but also what's key is NIPSCO itself is kind of what's part of a broader integrated market that energy market that really covers all of Indiana and, in fact, really the whole central part of the United States. So we have access. We essentially sell the power that we create to that market, and we buy what we need. And that occurs with all other utilities that are a member of this market. So it really provides diversity and location that NIPSCO customers gain advantages of, from everything down to the Louisiana coast all the way up to the Canadian border across the central part of the U.S. So while we have projects that we anticipate will be spread throughout the state of Indiana and even one more so announced in the northern part of Kentucky, we actually take value in our energy needs from the broader integrated market as well.
Well, Tara, it sounds like from NIPSCO's standpoint, it's going to be a very exciting years ahead as the initiative gets going and bring these opportunities in to bring more renewable energy into the picture here in the region.
Absolutely. We're super excited for, all of what's already been announced and what's to come here in 2021. definitely excited to be, making the state of Indiana more attractive to employers and residents, and definitely excited to begin saving our customers money.
Tara McMurray is with the NIPSCO headquarters team here in Merrillville, and Andy Campbell is also based with NIPSCO in Merrillville. He is the head of the Renewable Assets team. And Andy and Tara, thank you for joining us, telling us the latest involving NIPSCO and its renewable energy projects.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Yeah, happy New Year, so have a great day.
Telehealth services temporarily expanded during the coronavirus pandemic will be permanently expanded under a bill that was unanimously approved by the Indiana Senate on Tuesday. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith tells us that Valparaiso State Senator Ed Charbonneau calls those services transformational.
In 2019, IU Health had 7,400 telehealth visits. But last year, under expanded opportunities via Governor Eric Holcomb's COVID-19 executive orders, IU Health had more than 500,000 visits. Senator Charbonneau says providing more telehealth opportunities means more quality, affordable, and accessible health care.
There are fewer and fewer cancellations of appointments, fewer and fewer trips to the emergency room.
Senator Blake Dorio says he uses telehealth a lot for appointments with a back surgeon and a neurologist.
Telehealth saved me 2,100 miles of driving.
The bill now heads to the House. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Our thanks to our guests for being with us on the program today, and we hope you'll join us tomorrow for Reporters Roundtable Thursday.